Have you ever had one of those days where you just feel physically heavy?
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't mean you're carrying a heavy rucksack or you just did a brutal squat session at the gym. I mean your mood is so low that getting off the couch literally feels like lifting 1,000 pounds against gravity.
Right, yeah. It's a completely universal experience. I mean, we usually talk about that as a metaphor, right? We say things like we feel drained or weighed down.
Exactly. Or on the flip side, you get good news, maybe a text you were waiting for, and suddenly you're bounding up the stairs two at a time. You feel electric.
Yeah, you feel lighter.
Right. But what if that wasn't just a metaphor? What if that feeling was actual physics?
That is the big question for today.
It is. So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are unpacking a really dense but incredibly rewarding lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes on the history of philosophy. We're looking at two heavy hitters from the 17th century who essentially tried to crack the code of reality, Baruch Spinoza and Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz.
These are two thinkers who are operating right at this fascinating intersection of science, religion, and what we would now just call psychology.
And the mission for this deep dive is to bridge a gap, really. We're going to move from Spinoza's geometry of emotions, which is literally how to master your feelings using logic, all the way over to Leibniz's universe of energy, where we try to figure out what reality is actually made of.
And spoiler alert for everyone listening, it is definitely not what you think. We've got Spinoza effectively telling us that we're biological batteries.
Right.
And then Leibniz comes along and argues that the chair you're sitting on is made of sleeping spirits.
Which sounds completely wild, sleeping spirits. But when you dig into it, these ideas are actually precursors to modern neuroscience and, honestly, quantum field theory.
They really are. It's mind-blowing how far ahead of their time they were.
So let's jump right in with Spinoza. The source material, Dr. Holmes' lecture, points to a specific definition Spinoza gives for an emotion. He calls it a bodily modification.
This is super crucial to understanding Spinoza. He's a determinist.
Right, the cause and effect guys.
Exactly. He believes everything follows a strict cause and effect chain. So for him, an emotion isn't just some airy-fairy spiritual state floating around in your soul. It's a physical event. He says an emotion is a bodily modification that either increases or decreases the body's active power.
Active power. I want to drill down on this term because it feels like the core mechanic of his whole philosophy. When I heard that in the lecture, I immediately thought of causal energy.
You're on the right track there. Think about power not as, you know, political power or influence, but as the literal capacity to do work, to cause change.
Like voltage.
Yes, like a battery. Dr. Holmes explains that when something like excitement or joy hits you, what Spinoza just categorizes generally as pleasure, your power to act, your physical capacity to cause the next event in your life physically increases.
But when you're dejected or fearful.
That power is physically reduced, your battery drains.
So if I'm in a blinding rage or I'm paralyzed by anxiety, Spinoza would say my voltage, my ability to actually affect the world around me has dropped.
Well, rage is a tricky one.
How so?
Yeah.
Because rage feels energetic. You feel like throwing a chair.
It feels energetic, sure, but Spinoza would argue it's a passion. And he uses that word very specifically. It means something acting on you.
Oh, because you're passive?
Exactly. You aren't in control. The external cause, the guy who cut you off in traffic, is driving you. So your autonomy, your true active power, is actually diminished. You're just flailing. You aren't acting.
That distinction is key. And Spinoza ties this to his double aspect theory. Right? The idea that the mind and the body are just two sides of the same coin.
Yes. Spinoza is a monist. He thinks there is only one substance in the entire universe. So every physical change, that drop in battery power we talked about, has a parallel mental change. The mind is just the idea of the body.
So if the emotion acts on us, if we're just reacting to the weather or an insult, he calls that a passion because we're passive.
Precisely. We're being pushed around by the universe. But if we understand the emotion, if we stop, analyze the cause and understand exactly why we feel it transforms.
It stops being a passion.
Right. It becomes an idea. It stops being this vague force that enslaves us and becomes a clear, distinct thought that we can actually manage.
And this leads right into a term from the lecture notes, the Canatus.
Canonauts,
I
yeah.
have to admit, it sounds like a barbarian movie character. Canatus the Destroyer.
I can totally see the movie poster for that, but it's actually a foundational psychological concept.
Right, the striving.
Exactly. Canatus is the driving energy within all things to persist in their own being. In modern psychology, we still call it the connative. It's the wanting, the willing, the desiring part of us. It's the pure engine of survival.
So every single organism has this drive to just keep going. But Spinoza wrote his big masterwork, Ethics, and the last sections have these incredibly dramatic titles.
Human Bondage and Human Freedom.
Yes. So if we have this connatus, this powerful survival drive, why does he say we're in bondage?
Because of confusion. Spinoza says we are in bondage when we are driven by vague, confused ideas that get mixed up with our emotional feelings. If you don't know the exact root cause of your feeling, you are a slave to it.
It's like a leaf blowing in the wind.
Yeah.
You know, the leaf thinks it's flying, but really it's just being blown around.
That's the perfect image for it. If you don't understand why you're feeling a certain way, you're just reacting. You're being battered by external causes, and you call it your own choice.
So what's the jailbreak here? How do we actually get to human freedom?
You change your mind, literally. For Spinoza, freedom isn't about changing the outside world to suit your preferences. It's about acquiring clear and distinct ideas about why things happen.
It's the transition from being a passive recipient to an active understander.
Exactly.
So let's apply this to a real world thing for you listening. Let's say I'm furious that it's raining and it's ruining my picnic.
Okay.
Instead of throwing a tantrum, I understand the atmospheric pressure systems that caused the rain. I realize it was completely inevitable based on the laws of physics. And then what? I just accept it.
Yes. That is the Stoic twist in Spinoza's whole framework. He says virtue is a life ruled by reason. By understanding the causal mechanisms of nature, realizing that this specific rainstorm had to happen because of that specific pressure system, you accept it.
You acquiesce.
You acquiesce. And in that pure acceptance, the emotional sting is just removed. You gain peace of mind because you align your own mind with reality.
It's a bit unromantic, though, isn't it? He's basically saying virtue is its own reward. You don't get a cookie at the end. You just get to not be miserable about the rain.
I mean, sure, it's not a fairy tale ending, but consider the alternative. The alternative is being perpetually frustrated that the universe isn't bending to your specific will. Spinoza argues that the peace of mind is the cookie. The reward is the liberation from being emotionally jerked around by everything that happens to you.
That makes sense. And speaking of the universe, let's pivot to the ultimate concept here, God. Because Spinoza has a very specific view of God that got him into a massive amount of trouble in his day. He was basically excommunicated for this.
He was, very harshly, because Spinoza is a pantheist. He equates God directly with nature. He used the phrase duis of natura God or nature. They're exactly the same thing.
So God isn't a creator standing outside the universe, looking in and tinkering with things. God is the system. God is the physics, the matter, the mind, the whole machinery.
Correct. And because of that, Spinoza talks about achieving the intellectual love of God.
Loving the system.
Right. We can love the order of the universe. We can love the magnificence of how perfectly everything fits together in this infinite causal chain.
And this is the really hard part for a lot of people to swallow. The lecture is very specific about one thing. God does not love us back.
No, he does not. And we really need to understand the logic here, because it's not that Spinoza's God is mean or cold. It's that God has no passions.
Right, because earlier we established that a passion implies being affected by something outside of you.
Exactly. If I love you, your presence makes me happy. Your absence makes me sad. I am fundamentally changed by you acting on me.
But God is the whole system.
Right. Nothing is external to God. There is nothing outside the universe to act on the universe to make it happy or sad. So God cannot fall in love or feel pity. God just is.
So it's a one-way street. We love the structure, but the structure just exists. It doesn't hug us back.
Well, Dr. Holmes offers a really nuanced point from the text here that redeems it a bit. Since we are part of God, we are basically little modes of this one giant substance. When we love God, it's actually God loving himself through us.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's a self-love loop. We are essentially the eyes of the universe looking back at itself.
That's beautifully put, and that's exactly the logic. If God is all in all, then our love is just a fragment of the infinite self-love of the universe.
So salvation, or blessedness, isn't God smiling down at you personally and granting you a wish?
No, it's you consciously engaging in that loop. It's accepting your specific place in the cosmic order and finding joy in that profound connection.
So Spinoza gives us this very calm, almost mathematically precise way of dealing with the world. We are parts of a divine machine, and our only job is to understand the gears so we don't get crushed by them.
Yes, it's a philosophy of complete unity and absorption.
But then we move to the year 1700. and the vibe changes completely. We leave the quiet lens grinder's workshop of Spinoza and enter the world of Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. And this guy, he is a character.
He really is, the diplomat.
Yeah, Spinoza was basically a recluse, but Leibniz was a total globetrotter.
He was everywhere. Dr. Holmes points out that Leibniz wasn't some quiet academic sitting in an ivory tower writing papers. He was a German diplomat. He was constantly traveling, engaging in shuttle diplomacy across borders.
Trying to unite Europe, right?
Trying to unite the chaotic states of Europe and even trying to negotiate a reunification of the Catholic and Protestant churches.
Which is wildly ambitious.
Yeah.
And that personality trait, that deep desire to harmonize conflicting sides, bleeds right into his philosophy. Because the intellectual context of the year 1700 is an absolute battlefield.
Yeah. It's extremely polarized. On one side, you have the rise of the new mechanistic science. Think of people like Isaac Newton and Thomas Hobbes. They are saying the universe is just matter in motion, dead clockwork.
And on the other side,
religion, the church, the traditional belief in the soul, in free will, in cosmic purpose. And Leibniz looks at this new mechanistic worldview and he thinks it is deeply dangerous.
Dangerous in what way?
He felt that if you view the world purely as a machine, as just atoms bumping into each other, you completely kill free will.
Because if every thought in my head is just an atom hitting another atom, I didn't actually choose what to say just now.
Exactly. You're just a meat robot. And scientifically, Leibniz argued that mechanism couldn't even explain why matter behaves the way it does. Specifically, couldn't explain inertia or what the actual source of motion was.
So Leibniz decides he needs to step in and save individuality. He needs to save the soul from being crushed by this giant scientific machine. And to do that, he basically picks a fight with the biggest name in science, Isaac Newton.
The famous throwdown over space and time.
I love this debate because it is so counterintuitive to how we normally live our lives. We usually think of space as just space, empty air, a room. But Newton and Leibniz had radically different views on this.
Right. Newton viewed space as a giant, completely empty container. He actually called it God's sensorium. It's absolute, infinite, and totally uniform. Imagine a massive, infinite black box.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Even if you take out all the stars, all the planets, every single atom Newton thought the box of space would still be there. God just places things inside it.
It's like a stage before the actors walk on. The stage exists whether the play happens or not.
That is exactly how Newton saw it. But Leibniz flat out rejects this. He argues for relativity. He says space is just the order of coexistences.
Order of coexistences. Let's bring that down with a mental model for everyone listening.
Okay, imagine a universe with only one object in it. Let's say a single apple. In Newton's view, that apple is sitting at a specific coordinate in the giant invisible box of space.
Okay, it has an address.
Right. But Leibniz asks, if there is absolutely nothing else in the universe to compare it to, where is it? Is it left? Is it right? Is it up? Down?
Those words mean nothing without a reference point.
Exactly. So Leibniz would say the apple isn't anywhere.
Wow.
He argues that space is simply the relationship between things. If you remove the things, you lose the relationship entirely.
So if you took all the objects out of the universe, you wouldn't be left with empty space.
You would be left with nothing.
That is a much deeper concept than it sounds at first. It's like a family tree.
Yeah.
You can't have a brother relationship without two siblings existing. If you remove all the people, the concept of brotherhood doesn't just float around in the empty air waiting for them to come back.
That is a brilliant analogy. Space doesn't exist. Spatial relationships exist. And this realization leads Leibniz to ask his ultimate question. If the universe isn't a giant container full of hard, dead pellets of matter, what is the stuff? What is the actual substance of reality?
And this is where we finally get to the monads.
The monads.
Now, when I first heard this term in the lecture, I honestly thought of biology, like single-celled organisms, monads. But he's talking about physics, right? Or metaphysics.
Both, really. He's talking about the fundamental building blocks of reality. Leibniz proposes that the ultimate ingredients of the universe aren't material things at all. They are units of force. Or energy.
This is where he sounds like a time traveler from the 20th century. He's essentially saying matter is actually energy.
Yes. Dr. Holmes calls this a quasi-scientific hypothesis that directly anticipates modern energistic physics. Leibniz looks at a rock or a table and says, that's not solid stuff. That is a cloud of infinite little centers of force.
And these centers of force are the monads. But here is the part of the lecture that I found incredibly difficult to wrap my head around. He says these monads are windowless.
Yes. The monads have no windows through which anything could enter or depart. This is the absolute key to his whole system.
Okay, you have to unpack that for me. Because if they have no windows, how do they interact? If I bump into you, my atoms are hitting your atoms. That is interaction.
Leibniz says no, that's an illusion. Since a monad is a unit of pure, distinct substance, nothing can break into it, and nothing can leak out of it. They are completely isolated, purely private worlds.
Wait. If every atom, or monad, is an isolated world that cannot be touched by any other monad, how does the universe work? How am I literally talking to you right now?
This is where Leibniz introduces his wildest concept, pre-established harmony.
The synchronized clocks.
Right. Imagine two clocks hanging on a wall. They are ticking in perfect, flawless unison. One points to 12, the other points to 12. Are they affecting each other? Is the mechanism of one clock telling the other clock to move?
No. They were just set by the same watchmaker to run at the exact same speed.
Exactly. Leibniz believes God is the supreme watchmaker. He programmed every single monad at the very beginning of time to run a specific script. So when your mind monad thinks, I'm going to raise my hand, your body monads are already programmed to raise the hand at that exact nanosecond.
They aren't talking to each other at all.
They are completely deaf to each other. Yeah. They are just perfectly synchronized.
That is staggering. It's like this massive cosmic choreography where no one is actually touching, but everyone is dancing to the same beat flawlessly.
It creates a universe that is incredibly lonely in a way, yet perfectly connected, and it solves the famous mind-body problem for him. How does a ghost the mind move a machine the body? It doesn't. They just happen to be running on the same timeline.
So we have these infinite units of force running their internal scripts. But are they all the exact same? Is the monad in my coffee cup the same as a monad inside my brain?
No, and this is important. There is a hierarchy of being, and this is where Leibniz gets into what philosophers call panpsychism, the idea that everything has a mind.
Even the coffee cup.
Even the coffee cup. But don't worry, it's not judging your coffee preferences. Leibniz defines all monads by two properties, appetition, which is that drive or force we talked about, and apperception, which is awareness.
Okay, walk me through this ladder of awareness.
At the very bottom, you have bare monads. These make up rocks, dirt, water, inanimate objects. They have energy, but their perception is, in Holmes's words, dazed or stunned.
Like they're knocked out.
Right. They are like a person in a deep, dreamless sleep. They are there. They have an internal state, but the lights are very, very dim.
So rocks are basically dazed spirits. I kind of love that.
It's very poetic. Then you move up the ladder to soul monads or life monads. This is the animal kingdom. They have sensation, memory, habits. A dog knows its master. It learns from pain. It has distinct perception.
And then at the top of the physical ladder.
Us, spirit monads. We have self-consciousness. We have abstract thought. We reason. And unique to us, we worry about the meaning of life. We have a moral identity.
And ultimately, above us, the supreme monad is God.
Yes. Full consciousness, infinite clarity, boundless drive. The programmer of the clocks.
So let's zoom out and look at the grand contrast here, because it's a really stark difference between these thinkers. We have Spinoza, who says there is only one substance. You are just a tiny wave in a massive ocean. Your only job is to understand the ocean so you don't crash against the rocks.
Right. Monism. Total acceptance of the whole.
And then we have Leibniz, who says, no, reality is infinite, unique points of view. You are a sovereign center of force. You have a purpose, an internal script, a drive.
Pluralism, purpose and individuality.
It seems like Leibniz is really trying to give us back our human dignity. Spinoza kind of dissolves us into God, but Leibniz makes us little independent gods.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. Leibniz truly empowers the individual. He tells you that your active power isn't just something to be managed so you don't get sad. It's the fundamental reality of who you are.
He makes the universe feel alive.
Completely alive. It isn't a cold, empty box of dead atoms. It's teeming with force and perception.
It really changes how you look at the world around you. Dr. Holmes mentions how Leibniz sees even a seed buried in the ground as having a low degree of responsiveness. It quote-unquote knows to grow after the rain. The whole universe is waking up.
And that's the power of these deep dives into philosophy. Neither one is strictly right in the modern scientific sense. I mean, physicists don't believe in windowless monads or perfectly synchronized divine clocks, literally. But both offer an incredible framework for living.
Yeah, they give you tools.
Exactly. When you feel overwhelmed by chaos, Spinoza's deterministic acceptance is incredibly soothing. But when you feel meaningless or small, Leibniz's universe of purpose and living energy is invigorating.
It's basically like having two different operating systems for your brain, and you could boot up whichever one you need that day.
Precisely.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you listening with a final provocative thought to chew on. Something that builds on this but goes a step further. Leibniz argued that bare monads, like the ones making up the concrete of the sidewalk or the steel of your car, are just sleeping spirits, dazed and stunned, but fundamentally made of perception.
Right, the panpsychism angle.
If he is right, and the fundamental unit of the universe isn't a hard, dead pellet of matter, but a microscopic unit of consciousness, does that mean the universe isn't a machine at all, but rather a mind?
Oh, that's heavy.
And if the universe is a mind, are we just the universe thinking about itself from billions of different angles?
That is the ultimate question. Because if consciousness is fundamental to reality, then we aren't strangers here. We aren't accidents in a dead machine. We are literally what the universe is doing.
We are the universe waking up. A massive thank you to Dr. Holmes for the incredible lecture material that sparked all this. And thanks to you for taking this journey with us. We'll see you in the next deep dive.